there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your hair. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there.
Welcome to On the Wing Podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan. One of the requests of our new or newish national board chair, Jared Burke, is to find opportunities to highlight members of our national board of directors. And this is one of those opportunities. We're going to talk with three members of our national board of directors. All of them, I want to really highlight this, they are all volunteers. So I think that's really important to know. Every member of our national board of directors in some for-profit arenas, national board members are paid for or get a stipend. With Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, it's completely voluntary. They bring their time, talent, treasure to the organization because they care about it. And the three people in particular I'm referring to today, Keith Schopp. I struggled, Keith, whether I should call you as a resident of Illinois or of North Dakota. So we're gonna give you both distinctions today.
Great. Close to 50-50.
Is it really, though?
It is.
Okay. Yeah. And then we have, this almost became the Illinois podcast because Ashley Langan, also from Illinois with a side of Hawaii and Texas in there.
A little bit everything.
And then Owen Stockdale. There's some Iowa in the background, but you're in Minnesota,
yeah,
right?
I definitely claim some Iowa as well.
So we've got some unique backgrounds. We're going to learn a little bit about each of these participants in just a moment. As I mentioned, Purina Pro Plan. Keith, you worked for Purina Pro Plan. Are you going to just kind of make sure I say all this correctly, right?
Sure. I get a dollar every time I say Purina on a podcast. So.
Purina Pro Plan, as I mentioned, is the proud presenting partner of On the Wing Podcast, and they have been a long time national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. All three of my pups, Esky, Gitchy, and Winter, all eat Purina Pro Plan. Not just because Purina supports the wildlife habitat conservation mission of our organization, which is incredibly important to me, but what is also incredibly important to me is that Purina Pro Plan has the team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. So that makes me confident that when I go to the field, Esky, Gitchy, and Winter are going to have the fuel they need to be the best bird dogs possible. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. All right, so let's do a little round robin of biography. We'll go to Mr. Purina himself. Shop Talk. Shop Talk was, back in the day, sure, the name of your sports column, wasn't it, Keith?
Yes, it was. I was a journalist, still am by trade, and grew up in Southern Illinois. I went to Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville, worked for papers, wrote a column called Shop Talk. And then in 86, I went to Ralston Purina Company and spent 34 years there.
34 years at Purina.
Correct.
Wow.
And again, to fast forward a little bit, so I retired in 2019 and had a great opportunity to join the board of directors, and that's the year I joined in 2019. Hmm.
And did you grow up in Illinois, you say?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yep.
But yet, when you were writing Shop Talk, that was in St. Louis, wasn't it? Wasn't it right on the border?
I grew up in a town called Belleville, which is just across the river. Made that commute across that river to St. Louis every day for 34 years. But it was for a daily paper in Illinois, and I did work.
Oh, it was in Illinois. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh. In my mind, you were a beat reporter for the Cardinals. Is that accurate?
Correct. And I covered the World Series in 85, and we lost that one. So
one of the few the Cardinals have
that's
lost.
That's right. Yeah.
Did you cover other sports teams in St. Louis?
You know, I was more of a general columnist. I covered, you know, Illinois basketball and the Rams for a short time till they left.
Yeah.
You know, so
they left twice, didn't
yes,
they?
Yes, they did. So
I've always felt like I just feel like I have so much in common with you with the background in sports and you know, love of bird dogs and hunting. And by the way, you have two different breeds of dogs normally, right?
Yep, I have German Short Hair Pointers and Labrador Retrievers. I have two of each right now, and you know, Emma and Flora are the labs, and Stella and Willa are the short hairs.
You have two of each?
Yes.
Do you run them together, like pointers and flushers? He's shaking his head.
No.
Bob, that's a dumb question.
I have a pretty good scheme where I run each dog an hour independently, you uh-huh. know, and I can't run the labs with the pointers because that doesn't work well, yeah. you know, so...
What do you think about people that do? Where they so there's two schools. Mm-hmm. There's people that, you know, can have the lab go to sit when the dog goes on point or come back to heel. And then there's the folks that I love my dogs and I'm going to run them all together. What? So the first sort of thing. Have you ever trained both breeds to be able to A point and then B sit on whistle?
I can, the lab, I'm not that good, Bob.
me neither. I was just curious.
No, the lab is my oldest lab, just turned 10, by the way. She's phenomenal, but she is driven. I mean, she's on this mission to flush all the time, and she's so smart. When I do walk the dogs or exercise the dogs in a bird environment, she knows when the other dogs are on point, and she just goes in to flush. Now, I know there's a tactic when you're quail hunting down south and you have a cocker or something like that that will flush, and it's a great thing, but it doesn't work for me so well. so I'm happy to have one at a time typically, you know, the flushers are great in the cattails, and there's nothing like a pointing dog in the prairie, you know. So
all right, so we'll bounce across the table to Ashley Langan. And some folks probably know your name connected to the organization going back 10, 15 years as Ashley Bishop.
Right.
So tell us your life story up
sure.
to this point.
Sure. So when I was 6 years old, my dad founded our chapter in Montgomery County, Illinois, not too far from Keith. So I was taken to all the meetings and whenever we started having banquets and needed some administrative organization, my dad failed to understand how to work an Excel sheet. So
so your dad founded the chapter
mm-hmm.
there?
Yes.
In Montgomery County, Illinois?
Correct.
Do you remember, do you know what was the impetus for your dad stepping up
yeah.
and doing that?
Yeah, that kind of jumps to my later in life decisions. But both my parents are pharmacists. But my dad is a farmer at heart, so I'm from a farming family. Mm-hmm. But you gotta have a source of income to be able to buy ground, especially in Illinois. So
a farming pharmacist.
A farming pharmacist, yeah. License plate should be like PHARMER.
I didn't have that on my bingo card that there was a farming pharmacist
yeah.
out there.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yep. But that's where his heart is. Uh-huh. And so you know, some of my first memories are jumping off the school bus and running into the combine and doing math homework on the floor. So I loved the farm, but he's an outdoorsman. He's always hunted, you know, deer, pheasant, quail, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I was very used to that aspect too of, going out and learning about hunting and why we need habitat. Right.
Right.
My grandpa also taught me about soil health at a very young age. So all of that kind of clicked for me. And that that kind of sparked this precision ag mindset. I just thought everybody who was a farmer also was an outdoors, like also wanted habitat. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think that's where he started the chapter, was just his love of the outdoors and farming.
Cool.
So that's kind of when I got involved. So flash forward to high school, you know, so if, you know, 10 years later, mm-hmm. Still involved, still doing the administrative work for the chapter and going out and buying general raffle items and doing all the fun things, mm-hmm. Riding along on burns. And, then Pheasants Forever made the decision. I don't know if that was at a board, where the idea stemmed. I know Cheryl Riley was a big part of that.
Yeah, I think it was Cheryl's original concept.
Yeah.
And I don't know that the board, I think she kind of took the bull by the horns and said, I want to create this. I remember she had a conversation with Howard, and I got this idea, and they both said, this is great.
Yeah.
Go do it. And
that,
what we're referring to is the National Youth Leadership Council.
Right, right. And so it was a nationwide application process, kind of sent your resume in at the time and your involvement in the organization. And I was selected to represent Illinois on the National Youth Leadership Council, and then went on to chair that. You know, after a few meetings, we decided we needed to have some positions. So I chaired that all through high school. When I graduated, I went to Illinois State University, and precision ag, kind of bouncing back, precision ag was not a common, it wasn't a major at the time. I think since then, it's been a few years now, but I think South Dakota State kind of led the charge on adding precision ag as a major. So to do that, I chose to be a part of the geography department for a GIS, ArcGIS degree in spatial analysis, and then also simultaneously doing an agronomy degree. So I was in the ag department. So I did kind of the mapping and the soil science part of it. And that's how I made my own precision ag degree. And that is where I learned that the mindsets were completely different.
Mm.
Not all farmers appreciate habitat or understand the benefit of farming the best, saving the rest. And so that preservation mindset is growing up in Pheasants Forever and understanding the importance of that. Also coming from a farming family, understanding the economics behind, how to farm and why we farm and feeding the world, all of these things that we depend on agriculture for. So I then moved to Hawaii after graduation.
You got to explain that.
Well, I landed a pretty sweet internship on the island of Kauai the summer before I graduated. The summer before my I graduated early, they needed their Dow AgriScience was new to the island, and they needed to map their farm.
Okay.
And so that was my initial internship.
So Dow AgriScience had a farm in Hawaii.
Correct.
And they needed to map it with ArcGIS.
Correct.
For precision ag.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm the gal for you.
I can do that. I can also go to the beaches on the weekend. That'd be fine. So that was my initial internship, was mapping their farm. The seed corn business is very particular on, distances between genetics and things like that. So they needed it to be really precise. And so that's why they needed it to be digital and have a good understanding of the farm. Farming on a mountain is not exactly like farming in South Central Illinois. So I had to learn how to manage elevations and things like that. So we were there for 3 years and ended up, where I was there for my internship, ended up getting a job offer to move out there after graduation. So we did that. And then, so I grew seed corn since I had the ag background too. So I was part of the projects there. So after 9 growing seasons, 3 years, a little bit of the island fever set in.
So we talked a little bit about this before we hit record. You were there for 3 years and you had 9 growing seasons.
Yeah. There's no winter there. So you get to do a lot more stuff.
3 growing seasons a year.
Correct. Yep. And we had 2 different locations on the island, so weather is very, the island is only about 30 miles in diameter. So we had 2 different locations, which had very significant different atmospheres, you know, uh-huh. it was wildly different. So we would break it up, but yeah, three growing seasons per year.
And you said you were growing on the side of a mountain. I mean, is mm-hmm. this a volcanic mountain?
Not on Kauai. No.
Okay. All right.
But
did you see, I've heard stories of pheasants living in the pineapple orchards mm-hmm. of Hawaii.
So I've got pictures.
You're shaking your head with enthusiasm. Yes. I want to hear this.
I have pictures I can show you later, but they built brand new offices, and my office had, it was full ocean view, wonderful, and every morning I'd walk out or look out and there'd be pheasants everywhere. And sometimes I'd cuss them because they would eat my corn, but and we weren't allowed to touch them. Dad didn't own the farm.
Uh-huh. Could you legally hunt them?
But just our land owners wouldn't allow that. So, okay. I think that I don't know if it was regulated or seasoned. I don't know how it worked.
So you never hunted Mm-mm. pheasants in Hawaii?
No.
Did you ever think about starting a chapter in Hawaii?
I wanted to. I did want to. I think we would have had pretty good following. We had a pretty good group of friends over there that were really, how can you not be outdoorsy in Hawaii? Yeah. You know, so a lot of hunters, a lot of fishermen, a lot of, you know, I think it would have gone over pretty well, yeah. You know. We were there for 3 years and then made the move to the Panhandle of Texas. So from Illinois to Kauai, Hawaii, to Amarillo, Texas. So that's natural transitions, right? and there I worked for Wilbur Ellis, kind of back to the Precision Ag. So they had an in-house software, Ag Verdict, that I supported for 14 different ag retail branches in Texas, which is another complete different agriculture space, pivot irrigation and corners and, landscape is different. And so cotton, I didn't have any cotton experience. Mm. And so lots of learnings there in Texas. While we were there, my husband attended West Texas A&M WT in Canyon. That's where we had a house. It was in Canyon. And, got to get back involved a little bit more. There's a chapter around the Panhandle. So
was it a quail or a pheasant?
I think it's quail, top of Texas. Okay. I think it's a quail chapter. I met with them a couple of times. We didn't get super involved just because we were 12 hours from Litchfield still, but to me, we're close to home. So I got to get back involved, with our chapter, in Montgomery County. And so, after 5 years there, after Tim graduated his graduation was, May of 2020. So, at spring break is when COVID mm-hmm. hit, and that's also around planting season. Mm-hmm. And so we came up and helped on the farm
in Illinois
and kind of got stuck there because we couldn't go back, their travel, whatever. Mm. And so we just put the house up for sale in Texas.
Really?
And
so COVID made a complete shift in your life.
Yeah.
Career and home.
Right. Wow. Yes. So, we moved home, and that way Tim can farm, and he landed a job at Farm Credit with Illinois, or Farm Credit Illinois in our county. So since he got that job, I negotiated with Wilbur at that time, Wilbur Ellis, for a different role. So they allowed me to move to Illinois where they don't have really a presence. Mm. So I took a role with them in the business development space, which was completely new to me, but it was really cool to kind of stretch my boundaries. And so we got to test some ag technology that, we're seeing come out now, but it was really kind of cool to be on the forefront of kind of drone spray, first looking at drones and agriculture and all those different types of practices, and really dove into, carbon market and things like that were still futuristic at the time. Mm-hmm. But since then, I had a son, he's two now, and currently a stay at home mom and very proud of that.
What's your son's name?
His name's Grant.
Grant.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we've got one on the way. So we got a little girl coming in June, and, we live about a half mile from my parents' house and kind of back on the farm in the house that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. So, they built a new house and so kind of back to the roots, got to do our world travels and had some fun. Now we're trying to be adults, I guess.
You mentioned early on, kind of that you grew up with the mindset that every farmer thought about habitat, thought about conservation. That changed a little throughout your mm-hmm. career in agriculture business. Mm-hmm. Split, give me a percentage in your mind of each side of that equation, what you think of farmers that do think habitat every single day with the decisions they make. And then there's the other side where it's like, hey, I got to pay my mortgage. I gotta put food on the table. And they have to be very deliberate on the other side of that equation.
Sure. In my mind, in my area, because this is something that I've learned farming in different places, mm-hmm. that mindsets are different.
Geography makes a difference.
It makes a big difference. So in Illinois, for example, we don't irrigate. We fertilize very little compared to other places. So our inputs are different mm-hmm. Than like in West Texas, where it's sand or caliche, you know, the soil is just completely different. And so there's a lot more money spent on inputs between water and fertilizer. And so mindsets are different, but I would say in general, I would say 70, not so concerned about conservation every day. Mm-hmm. But I do think that because conservation practices have been made easier by farm equipment, and the options are, there's more options now, even in the last decade, you know, you've seen some advances. Mm-hmm. I think that practices have changed, and I think mindsets are kind of following with it just because of the ease of the practice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and the technology probably mm-hmm. makes the understanding of the conservation right. elements easier too.
Right. If you're able to, and this is what I did for Wilbur in West Texas, is I was, you're able to tie a dollar to a sub acre, you mm-hmm. know, if you can show what your farm is producing, what you're gaining off of it, or what you're losing, mm-hmm. mainly what you're losing, right. It's a lot easier to tell that story and make those decisions for the farmer a lot easier if they're able to see it on a map with a number.
Cool. Owen, thank you very much for waiting patiently here.
Amazing story.
It is, right? Go from Illinois to Hawaii to Texas to Illinois. A lot of background there, Ashley. Thanks for sharing it. Owen Stockdale, tell us a little bit about your background, because you came to the organization a little different too.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Northwest Iowa, the Lake Okoboji area. Got excited about the outdoors and hunting as a kid. Actually, my dad wasn't super into it, but I had an uncle that was pretty passionate, a few friends, and then some mentors, I guess, that I met along the way, and got involved actually with DU and the DU chapter in high school. And just that grassroots conservation bug certainly, you know, has been with me for quite a long time. And then fast forwarding, you know, after college and in grad school, I worked for a firm called McKinsey & Company, which is a consulting firm. I now...
Was that your first job out of college?
It was. I worked for another consulting firm in Boston, actually, and then a really? Private equity firm. And then I, for a couple of years, helped with my mom's company actually in Iowa that made die castings, a lot of them for John Deere and other ag equipment producers. But then I've been at McKinsey now for 18 years or so. I currently lead our agriculture practice. And my introduction to Pheasants Forever was quite exciting. This is 12, 15 years ago or so. I think it was 2 chairs ago, John Gottschalk. Mm-hmm. He was also involved with the Boy Scouts of America in our firm. McKinsey did a pro bono strategy effort with Boy Scouts. And then in, I think, 2011 or 2012, he reached out to our office and just said, hey, would you guys be interested in helping out at Pheasants Forever? And so, actually, I think it was 2012, you'll remember, Bob, that we had Pheasant Fest here in Kansas
you're
City.
You're right, yep. That's right, because we had those big strategic
exactly.
planning
meetings. Exactly, and so we kind of helped prepare and facilitate those sessions then. And I think, you know, what's come out of that over the last decade or so, I think, is quite exciting. And I'm sure, like many, super excited about where the organization is going. Obviously, there are crosswinds mm-hmm. That are out there, but just some of the leadership, the vision, the strategy, and just the impact that the organization's had, it's something that I feel super passionate about, our family feels very passionate about, and I'm just feel fortunate to be able to be a part of it.
It's funny that those sessions with McKinsey, you're the second person that has joined the board as a result. Yep. Shefali Mehta.
Yep.
Joined the board first out of McKinsey in those strategic planning sessions. And then Sam Reed was never on the board, but he was sort of a consultant for yep. multiple years after. It's amazing how much that connection with McKinsey was influential, not in the vision and the next strategic steps of the organization, but also just there was something in the Kool-Aid
yeah.
that you guys all kind of bought into the organization too.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, even in the last couple of years, as we've thought about some of the various workshops we've been doing, you know, we're very proud of our kind of agriculture practice and the people that are just very passionate about, you know, feeding the world, but while doing the right thing for, you know, the habitat and the wildlife that are on it. So it's, anytime I go back and say, hey, at PF, we've got this question or this issue, like 8 people raise their hand and say, hey, I can help. I want to help. So yeah, it's something that we're excited about. And, you know, there's just in an organization like this where we've got just an amazing staff, an amazing group of volunteers around the world in every chapter, but then also being able to connect that with, you know, all the resources that we possibly can to help move it forward.
So I want to ask you tell a little more about what you do for McKinsey, because you'll probably find this funny. I always think about McKinsey. You remember The Da Vinci Code? That really popular book they brought, right? I always think about the Illuminati. Like, McKinsey to me is this very cloak and dagger behind, like, closed doors. It's a consulting firm that is not brand forward, at least in my mind. Maybe I'm misperceiving it. But it's not an entity that is brand forward. It's always more quiet, supporting organization. A lot of Fortune 500 helping CEOs and leadership be better without any sort of here's what we do. It's just kind of in the background. Is that accurate, or have I read too many mysteries?
This is where I'm supposed to say no comment. No, there is something to that, right? We see ourselves as, you know, we try to be the men and women behind the men and women. And it's not about us. It's about anything we can do to help, you know, our clients. And that might be Fortune 500 companies, but it's also a lot of startups and smaller companies and community organizations and governments, etc. And so that is a bit of the ethos of it. It's a place where there's a lot of passion. I think in the world of, you know, agriculture, you know, the broader nature, natural capital, the issues that are facing, the big issues that are facing the world, it's something that we have a lot of people that are very passionate about it. And, you know, there aren't obvious answers. It's some part of what I think is so cool about what Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever are doing, is trying to figure out how to navigate through some of that. And we've got a lot of folks that are very passionate about that as well.
Because if I wanted to join a think tank, you'd be the person I'd call, like, how do I find a think tank? Do you know anybody that participates in think tanks?
I do. Yeah, indeed. I do think there's something for us. It's like, think tanks are interesting, but impact is more important, right? Mm-hmm. And so what do you actually do with it, right? Mm-hmm. And so we spend a lot of time not just about what are issues and what are opportunities, but then how do you actually get them done and how do you get to impact? So, yeah, it's
tell a little bit about your hunting, your personal life. What kind of dogs do you have?
Yeah, so I would love to say I'm a waterfowl and upland hunter. I've not just haven't been able to hunt as much waterfowl as I'd like. I really love duck hunting, but pheasant hunting is really my passion. We run a black lab female named Birdie. We bought her as a 4-year-old. She's now 7, but she's been super fun and is amazing with her kids. My wife would say she's her dog, but I claim her a bit as well. And we have some land in Northwest Iowa. I have a lot of buddies in Northwest Iowa. So most of my hunting is in kind of the Northwest Iowa area, and then try to get on a quail trip or two every year, Texas or otherwise. Love fly fishing. And so we just love to, you know, my wife is on this, a bit of a mission to getting our kids to national parks every year. So we're, you know, our vacations and our free time, which is not very much, but it tends to orient around the outdoors. And
do you have one on the summer plan national park you're going to this year?
We're still in the works, actually. Okay. I'm sure there will be, but our boys have been to 9 or 10 now. So it's in there.
And how old?
I've got twins that are 8 and a little guy that's 5 and
all three
boys, they're all starting to get pumped about getting outside and enjoying the outdoors as well.
Right on. So, you know, we've touched on how each of you have gotten into the organization, Keith, through relationship with Purina, Ashley with your dad, right, and National Youth Leadership Council, McKinsey, Owen coming through McKinsey. So somewhat different ways, kind of I'd say Ashley is the traditional, you know, through family connection, you know, then Keith through the corporate connection, and then Owen through kind of a consulting. But I can think about different people, you know, Owen, very similar to the way Matt Kaharsky got involved, right? And then, you know, the corporate, there's lots of folks that get involved in entities through a corporate relationship, bringing in organization or business closer to the organization than obviously the traditional chapter route. What I want to maybe go around the horn next is, in your mind, offer up what you think is the most valuable asset, you know, time, talent, treasure, maybe something different that you bring to the organization as a volunteer board member. We'll start with Keith.
Sure. Well, you know, Purina learned a long time ago that bird dogs need wild birds and wild birds need habitat, right? And so it was just a natural fit. And so I am really passionate about getting out there and preserving habitat and trying to tell the story, if you will. There's no better organization that delivers the habitat mission than Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. So I think my talent is probably in communication, and I'm also fortunate to be chair of the governance committee on the PF and QF board of directors. And so I really take that responsibility seriously. We're responsible for the board makeup, if you will, and bringing on board members with different skill sets and talents and from different geographies. So I'm really excited about that.
Ashley, what do you think is the most valuable assets you bring?
Yeah, so you kind of touched on it a little bit ago, but not all of our board members by design have participated in chapters. And that's on purpose. You know, it's good to have outside opinions who haven't, you know, kind of lived and breathed the chapter model. But I am from a chapter, and it's also important to have a chapter voice on the board. Yeah. So in addition to like the ag mindset and conservation, you know, the main things this organization is passionate about, I think my seat at the table is that representation for the chapters and our membership base, and making sure that they're taking into consideration on big decisions or you know what's happening with the organization. As long, you know, I think it's important that we protect that chapter model because it is unique to different organizations across the nation, and so kind of preserving that and making sure that's taken into consideration.
I think that's super important for our chapter volunteers who listen to every podcast to hear, you know, that is a purposeful thought process from Keith on down, that, you know, we want to make sure that there's chapter participation. Because once upon a time, right, like you dial back 40 years, every board member was connected to a chapter, and that's changed over time for necessity. With the addition of Quail Forever, we had to find quail representation, as you mentioned, in the Southeast and the Southwest. So the goal ultimately is for the board to reflect the mission geographically, the membership and the sensibilities, the demographics. So I think it is really important that they hear there's a conscious effort to put chapter voices around the board table. What about you, Owen? What do you think is the that maybe it's the secret society, though. No. What's your biggest asset you bring?
Yeah, and by the way, I would just say, I think I'll speak for all of us, that people take it very seriously. They take the fact that we have the opportunity to represent the chapters, and that's, which is really, you know, the heartbeat of this organization, very seriously. And it's a very inspiring kind of experience. And I'm grateful to Keith for getting through the process he just described. Yeah, you look from my angle, I think, just trying to bring some of the practices and approaches we use in you know, the business and corporate world, you know, to the table, of just continue to stretch our thinking, I think, and also just connecting. I think there's a massive synergy with corporate agriculture and global agriculture and agribusiness matters a ton in this world. And so I that's where I spend my kind of weekdays, and I try to spend my weekends trying to help here. And I think there's a lot that could be learned both ways.
It makes me think one of my personal pet peeves is the word nonprofit. And here's where I'm coming from, because I want to get your reaction to that. Like, when people hear nonprofit, I think there's a perception that, well, money doesn't really matter, right? And the reality is, when you're talking about a nonprofit, money absolutely matters. The purpose of the money, though, is for a very specific purpose. It's not to generate revenue for owners or shareholders. It's to generate revenue, not for the purpose of the profit, but for the purpose of the mission. And I relate this back to sports. Big surprise, right, Keith?
Yeah, sure.
But I think there's a lot of parallels between our organization, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, as a nonprofit, and say the St. Louis Cardinals. And people out there probably scratching their head like, where the hell is Bob going with this? But my thought process is, follow me here, as a nonprofit, just like a baseball team, you need to generate revenue, right? Outdoor, outfield billboards, logo bat night, selling tickets. You generate revenue to what? Accomplish a mission. In the case of the St. Louis Cardinals, it's to win the World Series, to have the right players, to achieve a goal. And the goal doesn't end. You know, there's always next season, but it's to generate revenue as a business, to be profitable, to win a goal. And then you start it all over again. And when I think about Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, I think very similarly. It's like how successful we are in running our business to generate revenue gets us further down the road to achieve our mission, and our mission is constantly changing. There's always going to be a next season. You know, there's no World Series to win, but there is, you know, battles to fight for the world of conservation. And the more effectively and efficiently we can run our organization, not as a nonprofit, but as a business, allows us to achieve our habitat mission. Does that jive for you?
100%, and in a world that's changing dramatically, and so we've got to keep innovating and finding new ways to do that. I'd love to have as many championships up in Minnesota with our Vikings as they do in the so I could go there too.
True Minnesotan brings it back to the Vikings,
you know, or the Hawkeyes, by the way. But yeah, absolutely, and I think that focus and that acumen is critical, and I think the organization has done a great job. But you know, as we think about the next 10, 20 years, there will be new opportunities, but also some new challenges, and we're going to have to keep pushing it hard.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to go to a bit of a lightning round here. Before I do, I want to thank Onyx. Onyx Maps is a proud national partner of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. They give back to that habitat mission to make our organization the most effective that it possibly can be, and you can help. Go to the link in the show notes. It'll take you to Onyx Hunt website, where you can join or renew your membership to Onyx. Use the code PFQF, and you'll get 20% off your subscription to Onyx, and they will make a contribution back to our wildlife habitat mission. So you probably got turkeys on the brain. Get to Onyx, get 20% off, and they'll make a contribution that'll help us further down the road. All right, a little bit of a lightning round. We'll start with Keith. We'll go around the horn. In your view, from your chair as a member of the board of directors, what's the largest habitat opportunity in front of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever?
I think access to public hunting and private lands is huge. You know, there's a program, the PATH program. Is
public access to habitat, PATH.
Correct. Yeah. And it's modeled after that Aberdeen
Pheasant Coalition.
And I think that's a huge opportunity. I mean, you can learn a lot more about it by going to the website.
Pheasantsforever.org/PATH, PATH.
You know, and kind of related, I think membership with PF and QF is at an all-time high, but I still think we're scratching the surface. You know, I think every man, woman, and child who hunts, and not only people who hunt, but people who want clean water and soil health and enjoy a monarch butterfly, mm-hmm. you know, should be a member of this organization. And I mean, I think we're at what,
155, give or take.
And again, that's just a simple metric, but I mean, I think we should be at a million, you know, mm-hmm. and with scale and with more members, I think
comes more habitat.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think, Ashley?
Back to the Ag Roots. I think that one of our biggest opportunities is really partnering with the farmers in the ag community and have a conversation and so both parties can realize that we have the same goal. You know, we want to treat the earth, the soil, with good intentions. We're all out here for good intentions, right? So let's talk about it. Let's get on the same page and let's work together. I think that's probably one of our biggest opportunities.
How do those conversations take place? Is it through the precision ag specialists and the farm bill biologists?
They're multi-level. They're such a big part of it, because they're out there walking the fields and having those initial conversations. And so sometimes that's the first exposure that a farmer will have to understand what programs are available for them, what their options are. A lot of our biologists, RPF and QF biologists, their offices are in NRCS buildings, and farmers are walking in and out of there every single day, and so we have a lot of touch points, and we're very fortunate to have that. So let's break it wide open and start having these conversations and understand. Let's from our side, let's understand the concerns. Let's present the options and the opportunities and change happens over time. It's not going to change a farming practice that day. But let's talk about your next planting season. What might go better? What can we help with? So
in Hawaii, you have three different opportunities.
You're right. You don't sleep. Yeah. So many opportunities.
What do you think, Owen?
It comes to my mind is just creativity. Mm. The more you learn about what's happening in each different state, across different chapters, and all the different regions of the ways to preserve habitat, it's actually really boundless. Mm. So I just think is the more we get our message out that if you have an idea about how to either help your operation as a producer or to create habitat in your county, your state, whatever it may be, we've got methodologies, we've got approaches, we probably have some lessons learned and ways to do it. And so I think that's something I've always just admired about the organization, is just all the different ways that we can actually go activate, which I think is extremely powerful.
I really like that. I think about, the different elements of the secret sauce of the organization.
Yep.
And part of it is the flexibility, where we don't have to be so rigid in how we attack habitat in Georgia versus Illinois versus, North Dakota. They can all be a little bit different because the people are different, the landscapes are different, the birds can be different.
100%.
And I think that's a great point. Same question, but from a business angle, not just habitat mission angle, but from a business angle, is there anything that comes to your mind that there's a big opportunity, Keith?
Sure. So we had a great board meeting yesterday, and I one of the headlines is finding additional revenue streams. Okay. Mm-hmm. So whether it's, from corporate, our foundations, our individuals, I think that's a big opportunity and something that, again, we are looking at and we will pursue. But
so diversified revenue streams is kind of the foundational principle for most businesses, right? And it's true of our organization.
Sure.
The more diversified, whether they're from companies. So if companies are out there listening, we want you. BobS@pheasantsforever.org. Help us put habitat on the ground. What do you think, Ashley?
I think we have a gap right now with our colleges and universities. Hmm. So I think that there would be an opportunity to kind of get into those spaces, kind of create a early working force, get those relationships going. And, you might know the stat better than I about, we hire for what we have the largest hiring capacity.
I'm just that we have the second most biologists employed.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Of any entity in the country, next to only the U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Right. So if we can get into those programs and start working with with folks early on, and you know, that I think that would be a great opportunity for our organization, along with collegiate chapters. Mm. That's I started one when I was at ISU. It's hard. It's a struggle. It's a different world than a traditional chapter, and I don't know that we've explored that. I think DU has a pretty good presence in colleges and universities.
Yeah,
and
we maybe have 6 to 8 chapters in universities, and the turnover is high there, right? You know,
so
generally
fast.
Speaking, every 4 years, like, you know, some students will be maybe 6.
Right, well.
But, you know, 4 years, and then you got to find a new crop of volunteers.
Right, so I just think that's an opportunity for us from a business standpoint.
Cool. Owen.
For me, it's I don't know that everyone appreciates the endowment, if you will. And so, you know, this organization has impacted, I don't know what the number is, but 28 million acres is the number I have in my head.
That's right.
And, you know, that's massive. That's a third of the U.S. corn acreage. And so if we think about all the good benefit that has occurred on 30 million acres, what does that matter? How do we tell that story? How do we, in a world where people are looking for, you know, better water solutions, biodiversity solutions, et cetera, how do we really understand what's already been done and then chart a pretty bold path for what we can do going forward? Because this is the best organization at putting habitat in the ground. And it turns out there are benefits way, way beyond pheasants and quail production. And I think that is a sleeping giant for the organization.
Sleeping giant in terms of everybody in the U.S. population benefits, but only a small percentage, to Keith's point earlier, really know it or give back to it.
Exactly.
Hmm. All right, let's flip that. We're kind of doing a SWOT analysis, right, for folks following along. We're at that threat component. What keeps you up at night, Keith?
I guess, you know, one of the threats I think would be to fall into some level of complacency, and it goes back to if not now, when kind of a thing. Mm. And so, I mean, we heard last night at the Bob White Ball how many acres we're losing, you know, every year, how many quail there used to be versus now. I don't have this.
Sure.
But so that's concerning me. And I know that every day the great team of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, they go out and they have this mission, you know, and it's, we've got to turn it up, and you know, we got to somehow hold the tide, you know, kind of a deal. So that's what keeps me up. I mean, I know in Southern Illinois, for example, less and less quail every year, and you know, the graph is just going down, and it's to have bird dogs, and you know, you'd love to have a couple of contacts with coveys every time you go out, and that doesn't happen. So that's a long answer, maybe.
It's a daunting task.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Ashley, what do you think?
I think kind of going back to Owen's point about creativity, like what else? What are some options that we have? What are spaces that we haven't touched? And if we ignore, you know, some of these crazy ideas, what are we missing out on?
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's a lot of money, a lot of brain power, a lot of people in urban spaces.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing to capture that? What, you know, I think Detroit has a pretty awesome example of creating some green space.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's those types of opportunities. What happens if we ignore unconventional spaces?
Mm.
So I think that can be a threat. Just because they're different and scary, if they get ignored, what happens? What do we miss out on?
Always have an open mind, right? Owen.
Just ensuring that we're evolving with, if I may say, the why, right?
Mm.
So there's a core group of that just is an amazing part of the heartbeat of this organization. The reality is the way people interact, the way people they engage, is evolving, and you're doing a ton, Bob, with social, et cetera. But are we activating with the why of the next generation? I mean, there is a demographic challenge that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And so are we at least keeping pace, if not getting ahead of that, I think is, something we've got to keep an eye on.
Explain that a little bit further for folks.
I'll use an example, professionally. So at McKinsey, it turns out like you'd imagine graduating folks from colleges and business schools or technical schools, you'd say, oh, they all want to work for Google. They all want to work for Amazon, which is, there's some of that true. They actually really want to work in the food and ag space. They want to be a part of agriculture. And so there's a talent orientation, and there is a mindset of making the world and the planet a safer place for the forever. And so I don't know, are we tapping into that enough? If you went to some of the leading technical schools, go to Georgia Tech, go to, you know, Berkeley, whatever they are, you're going to find people that are super passionate about exactly what PFQF does. And are we in front of that enough? So that'd be my question.
Cool. All right. So as we round to a close, I got a fun question to end this, but I'll throw more of a, like, this is an open forum sort of thoughts that you want to bring up about the organization, maybe favorite aspects, underappreciated aspects, anything that you want to leave listeners with on the front of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever before we go to a fun closing question. We'll start with Keith.
Sure. So, we started out, I'm 50-50 in terms of Illinois and North Dakota, and it's so important to me. When I really knew I wanted to be a board member of this organization, I was in North Dakota, and way out in the prairie, there was a sort of a women on the wing, learn to hunt. And I mean, there was nobody around for it, and it was just so cool to have these, you know, I can name names, but the biologists from PF and were there, and how passionate they were and how much, you know, they cared about teaching and learning and trying to do their job, you know. So I think that motivated me. It's like you have to have your boots on the ground out there and see that to really feel, you know, that you want to charge for this organization. And so, again, I'm rambling, but that really, to me, that's what this organization is.
It is infectious, I think, if I can put it different to me. When you get around our coworkers, the employee team, the passion and the dedication is infectious. That stretches from North Dakota to Illinois, from North Carolina to South Carolina, or South Dakota. People really live this organization as part of their life. So is that putting into words what you're talking about?
100%. Yeah. So
what do you think, Ashley?
I the impact of what we do is phenomenal. Our name suggests pheasants and quail. It was obviously we strive to put more birds, get more birds out there. But like Keith mentioned, the monarchs and the flower, you know, wildflowers, and it is so much more than just pheasants and quail. And so you don't have to carry a gun every time you go hunting. You don't have to just walk the prairie and appreciate, understand everything that this organization is impacting, along with all the missions. It affects so much, and it's amazing to see and share with people who, I don't want to hunt. I don't want to carry it. That's fine. Come with me and let's see what else we can see. And I think that's really cool.
How often do you get that question from folks in your circle? You're like, why are you involved so deeply?
Yeah. They know that my friends, from college or, whatever, know that I come from a hunting family. And so it kind of seems like a no-brainer, but in reality, I love flowers. So the wildflower aspect and, bringing in a bouquet of flowers for my friends, and they're like, where did you get these? I'm like, let me show you a place. it's a big eye-opener whenever you're able to talk about something other than the birds themselves. And I think that could be a pretty good attraction for those folks who are just thinking about it but not quite sure what we're all about. It's a whole slew of things. You don't have to hunt if you don't want to, so
you can still enjoy the beautiful habitat that's created.
Right.
All right. Help me put a bow on this component of the conversation.
I think every mission needs a moment. And I think when a mission as compelling as what PFQF does and can do meets a moment like we have right now, I get extremely excited. And so I think there is something about having great organizations that just are a little too soon or a little too late, or a big need where there's no one there to meet it. And for me right now, as we think about this moment and in the habitat mission that we have in this country and globally, you could argue, and then what Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever does, it could be magical. Hmm. And so I think there's no reason that it shouldn't be. If you look at, you know, there was a long decline of slow decline of membership prior to the pandemic. Since then, it's been growing at a really impressive rate.
Right.
There's energy out there. There is a need out there. And so I get quite excited about, you know, the impact that we can collectively have with everyone. That's amazing. Cool. People that are a part of it.
That's a very positive, optimistic way to end this part of the conversation. Thank you. That's wonderful. I share your excitement, enthusiasm, and I haven't thought about kind of every mission needs a moment, but that's reality. You know, out of COVID, for instance, right? Pressure put on the system, things change, right? People went back to the outdoors. I just use that as an example of context, right? And that's happening right now everywhere you look.
100%, yeah.
All right. Final thought, little fun. You can go on a hunt or a walk with anybody, anywhere, for any bird. Where are you going? Tell me about your trip. Go ahead, Keith.
Sure. So I'm proud that I have, I think right now, 7 Dog Life members, okay? And some of them are not with us anymore. Mm. So I would want to take a walk with those dogs again.
Mm.
That's it.
Yeah. Nobody has ever answered that question that way. That strikes to the heart. Yeah. I can think about my first bird dog, taking a walk with Trammell again. That'd be very meaningful. That's a good one. Ashley?
I'm going to one of my dad's farms. It is actually one of the, it was put into CRP the very first year that CRP was available.
So really?
It's been in CRP the entire time. And he bought it from somebody who put it in CRP. So he wasn't the one. But he's maintained it. And when he bought it, my grandpa was alive. And so he saw, you know, he saw where it was, which was in great shape. But I would bring grandpa along for a hunt. I never got to hunt with my grandpa. He lived well into my 20s, but it just never worked out that we got to go hunting. He was a fabulous quail hunter. So we would go check out, I want him to see dad's property, how it's flourishing, and all the birds that we have gained since he's left us, and take my son and my husband with me. Grandpa didn't get to be my son. So we're taking a family trip to the family property and seeing what's changed over the years.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very nostalgic. I think a lot of people can identify with that. All right, Owen.
I'm going to stay on a similar thread. There's maybe 20 buddies that will know the story, but it's a little bit about ensuring that you don't miss it. And so I'm guessing there are other 40-something super busy dads out there that can relate. But, you know, 5-6 years ago, I was actually sitting watching a football game with my dad, and he asked me when I was getting my buddies together, something I did a lot of when I was in college. And he's like, all you do is work. You got, you know, 2 little kids. The third was on the way. And you're just not making time to do the stuff you always used to do. And I was like, yeah, I'm in the heat of my career. Yes, I love to bird hunt. I love to quail hunt. You love to fly fish, but I just didn't do it enough. And we're sitting here watching. It was actually a Kansas State game. And he's like, I didn't get scolded as a kid. I was a pretty good kid. But he is one of the few times that he got mad, got mad at me. And
this is in your 40s.
This is 5 years ago. And he said, don't wait. Stop waiting, Owen. And that was, it was a really powerful moment. He actually passed away just a couple weeks after that. And so,
we knew it was very meaningful that he said this to you, and
just that ability to convene people around the outdoors is something that I've always valued, but frankly something that it was the classic thing of, you know, the conversations, let's go hunting sometime, let's go fishing sometime, and then who sets it up? And so I've been pretty committed to, I host a hunt of a group of, you know, a bunch of professional, you know, peers, but dads that love to be outside, and we do that in November in Iowa. We do a fly fishing trip. But just that idea of, you know, for me, I mean, I, you know, traveling the world, working way too many hours, but then not making the time to be with the people that I care most about. And so just that idea of, you know, whether it's taking the extra walk with the dogs, you know, spending the time with your family farm with your kids, but like, if we all did one more trip and convened one more group every year, what would that do? And, you know, 160,000 members of this organization, if we all did one more and talked ourselves out of waiting just a little bit more and just do it. It's just something that's been on my mind pretty heavily and I'm committed to.
That's a perfect way to end this conversation. Don't wait. Whether it's taking the hunt or getting involved in the organization too.
Exactly.
So we all have habitat for those walks with the dogs and the grandpas and the grandmas and dad. Thank you very much for sharing this, guys.
Thank you.
For Keith Shop, Ashley Langan, and Owen Stockdale, I am Bob St. Pierre reminding you to don't wait. Always follow the dog. Something good will rise, folks. Thanks for listening.